Hello, listeners, and welcome to Politico's Nerdcast. I'm Scott Bland, your host. This week on the show, we're going to dig into the big development in the 2020 presidential race of this week. That's Senator Kamala Harris of California dropping out of the Democratic primary a couple months before the Iowa caucuses. Her campaign struggling in the polls, struggling financially. She decided to pull the plug, let folks know on Tuesday, had qualified for the debate that's coming up in December, but obviously won't appear on the stage. We're going to dig into what went on in that campaign, how it all came to this after that much-heralded launch earlier this year. And then in the second half of the show, we're going to dig down at the voter level into, among other things, some of the reasons about why Kamala Harris dropped out this week. We're going to talk a little bit about how the presidential candidates are connecting with different demographics and how much these early primary states, Iowa and New Hampshire versus South Carolina and Nevada, really differ from each other demographically and what effect that's having on the campaign. So we're going to sit down with a couple of reporters who study that and have dug into it really deeply. Quick note, we're taping this on Thursday, December 5th, a little bit before noon. So anything that happens after that point this week, we're going to have to address it in a future show. But right now, let's jump right into that first segment. We're going to talk Kamala Harris. And here to do it is Politico national political reporter and Kamala Harris expert, Chris Catalago. Hi, Chris.
Great to be here.
So it's funny. On Tuesday, the day that this happened, you and I spent the morning chasing a very different sort of story about Harris.
Yeah. We learned after we were chasing this that a couple of her former top aides, folks who had worked either on her campaign or around her, had spent months basically reaching out to donors and developing a super PAC that would come in around the time that she might be able to give it blessing, right? That she was sort of running low on her own campaign funds, and they had reached this point where they were willing to go back on their pledge that they were not welcoming a pro-Harris super PAC. And so they went out and they found this one quote-unquote angel investor in her campaign out of the Bay Area and had just reserved initially more than 300,000, but they said they had more than a million actually to run ads in Iowa. And we started to look into it, reported on it, and obviously, you know, it was not to be.
Yeah, I mean, so you published the story about all the details about this, who's behind it, the money involved, that the super PAC is riding to her rescue in Iowa, and then 2 hours later, her campaign is over.
Yeah, and the interesting thing was we started to get texts from the folks involved in the super PAC that we then went and tweeted of the ad itself, and they were very proud of the ad. They spent their Thanksgiving holiday actually cutting this ad after doing a bunch of polling. And there was sort of this collective shrug on their part, like, hey, take a look.
It would have been great.
Yeah, exactly. One of them took a screenshot of our website when we published the story within, I think, less than 2 hours of the super PAC story going up of both headlines side by side and said that they were going to frame it for posterity.
Gallows humor, nothing new to presidential campaign strategist. Must have been an incredible feeling of frustration for some of the people in the campaign seeing that super PAC pop up to come save them. And then, of course, there's no, you know, coordination allowed between a campaign and a super PAC. And then, you know, it just happens to come on the day that they're deciding to end things.
Yeah, there certainly was a feeling in the campaign that this had come too late. And it was just another sort of cruel irony for them. We know that some of the folks on our campaign or top advisors had know the folks behind the super PAC really well, and when they knew the campaign was over, actually reached out to them and kind of made that point themselves that too bad this had to come on the same day. But and the folks on the super PAC side, of course, we know the rules and there's no coordination allowed, kind of said, well, at least this proves that there was no coordination here.
Small victories.
Yeah.
So, Chris, what happened on Tuesday? Harris gathered her staff.
Yeah, basically over the weekend, starting with the Thanksgiving break, Harris, who was in Iowa at the time, cooking and, you know, meeting with various voters, sat down with her husband, her sister, her brother-in-law, her niece, other family, and really talked this over. It's kind of funny because we go from a year ago when a lot of these campaigns were sitting down with their family in similar settings and talking about whether they should run. And this time it was a question about whether she should end her campaign. She also spent a lot of time looking over the current financial state of her campaign. And that was a big part of her decision to pull the plug now. Obviously, we know she qualified for the debate later this month. So she was going to be in that no matter what. But California itself, toward the end of the month, has this deadline to take yourself off of the California ballot. And so she was looking at that as well. There were a lot of things that went into this consideration. She ended up, as you said, doing this all-staff call that we started getting text about as well. And on that call, which obviously she was very sort of upset in the moment, it was a very difficult call for her to make and tell staff who had spent a lot of time and a lot of their energy working on this campaign that she was ending it.
Chris, what happened? Harris entered the race with so much promise. Senator from the biggest state in the country, fundraising base there. She spent the couple years before running for president building up an online fundraising base of the sort that we thought might be able to sustain a campaign. Obviously not, as you alluded to, there were some serious financial issues with her campaign, but she entered the race with such fanfare.
Yeah, and looking back on it, even in the moment and talking with folks on her campaign, there were warning signs throughout the spring. She was having a tough time kind of getting, in some sense, kind of answering basic questions out there. And that was just not coming together for her. She had a tough time within days of her announcement on Medicare for All, of course, and then spent a lot of the spring in South Carolina trying to make inroads. But her numbers just never really moved there to any degree. I remember writing about way back then Joe Biden's kind of stranglehold over the state, essentially, particularly African-American voters. And so then we kind of flash forward to the first debate in Miami, and we saw this moment where she took on Joe Biden. Overall, she had a strong debate, but that sort of vaulted her back into this conversation and into the top tier. She raised a huge percentage of the money she ended up raising over the whole campaign, which I think was almost $40 million. Came, in the aftermath of that moment and the few days after that moment. And so there was sort of a renewed promise in her campaign. And then ever since then, we know that she was sort of tripped up over the fallout to that, in part by the Biden campaign and not really being able to articulate how her position on busing for school desegregation was any different than his. And so it was just a long slide from there.
Yeah, like you mentioned, I think that moment ended up, instead of being a harbinger of things to come, it was more of a sugar high that obscured the problems of her campaign. But the thing you mentioned about kind of spending, it seemed to be a recurring problem where she would say something and then kind of spend the next few days trying to alter or clean up after it, whether it was on Medicare for All, whether it was regarding busing in the aftermath of that confrontation with Biden. There were a couple other issues as well where, like you said, it seemed that she had trouble articulating exactly what she either wanted to be what she wanted to be saying, or maybe she was having trouble kind of deciding on exactly what she wanted to say in the first place.
Part of it was that. Part of it was defining her own position and her own stance on it. The other was sort of an uncomfort each of these times that something led to a broader conflict or a broader clash with someone, and almost not wanting to see herself in opposition to them. She wanted to be able to kind of make the point of how it affected her without having to deal with answering to how it might affect an opponent. And we saw that later with Elizabeth Warren, where she, mentioned some of the things that could have been kind of tied to Warren in her background as late as the Iowa LJ speech, and then was asked within a couple days of that, you said that you've never worked for corporations, you've always worked for the people, kind of being drawn into to a clash with Warren. And she said, no, that had to do more with my own background. So there was certainly like just a constant uncomfort. We saw it with Biden. We saw it with some of the others. In how she wanted to see herself and how she wanted to see herself played off the other candidates.
And then all that led up to this point at the end of October. And I'm looking back through the stories on your author list on the Politico website. But basically, a series of stories leading up to this point, starting at the end of October with a scoop, the headline, Kamala Harris to slash staff and restructure campaign. Desperately low on cash at that point, leaving her no choice but to kind of lay off people, some of whom she'd hired relatively recently. And that's always a bad sign.
Yeah, another kind of through line for the campaign was picking this sort of initial strategy, whether it was focusing on South Carolina and California and the later states, and then making this pivot almost when it was too late. And she did that with Iowa. And the money situation was the same. The structure of her campaign situation was the same. I think we wrote in late September about how she was going to kind of shake up her staff and put more people in charge of various departments. And that came, you know, at a time when basically people were talking about how there were no senior staff level meetings for month after month. And so it was kind of this like a long way of pursuing the theory of the case, and then this very quick and abrupt overcorrection, whether it was the map or it was her own staff, and then, of course, money, which you were alluding to, which was this this buildup that they had over the third quarter. They figured they needed to kind of play in all these states and have staffers on the ground. And then when they made this hard pivot to Iowa, they figured they were going to have to drop a lot of folks at the headquarters in these states. Of course, that came too late. And it also came at a time when, you know, the money just wasn't coming in. I mean, they figured they had to do this build out at some point if they were really going to play. And so what they were up against was the fact that she had basically stalled out, and there was no way that they were going to capitalize on the online money. And, you know, donors start to read the stories about staff unrest and about her campaign stalling out, and it becomes this sort of vicious cycle where you can't raise money.
Vicious being the key word there. And some of the there were some staffers who were coming in for really really rough treatment, and the press getting blamed for a lot of this. And Chris, you've talked about in diagnosing the problems in Harris's campaign, you've talked about the, you know, a little bit of struggle to find a consistent message on a few different things. And you did some reporting that kind of suggested to me it's that this struggle was personified a little bit by a push-pull within her campaign among kind of two competing power centers.
Yeah, she comes from a legal background, and she likes to set up these organizations around her where people are pitching their ideas and making points and arguing things out in real time. And the structure that she had set up didn't necessarily, for most of the campaign, have anyone with any, you know, true responsibility over a particular department. So she had a team of advisors from San Francisco, and then, of course, Margolis, who came in as well, the ad man and her pollster. But at the campaign level, there was a lot of push and pull between her campaign manager, who works with these advisors as a partner, and her sister, who was her campaign chair. And a lot of folks within the campaign, whether they were senior level staff on down, had a tough time figuring out the structure of the campaign and who they were really answering to. Was it the sister, who they know had Kamala's ear throughout this process, and was she a better person to go to with points? Or was it the campaign manager, who was really in charge of this campaign? And that was a constant question that came up among staff. And I think it led to a lot of the questions around her scheduling. I mean, this manifested in a lot of sort of hands-on ways that people needed answers in real time on things, including, you know, everything from what, you know, TV show she was going to go on to what state she was going to go visit next, what she was going to do. And I think it became very frustrating when day after day for long periods of time, people just couldn't get answers. And a lot of it just had to do with the campaign manager needing to check in with her sister, or her sister needing to check in with someone else, and then not getting back to staff. And so it's not just a question of who's in charge and who has kind of power over the decision. It's a question of who's then relaying that down to the staff level. And that was just a recurring thing that really started to plague her campaign.
So, Chris, what happens next for Kamala Harris? I mean, you've been covering her for a long time. You're in California before you came to Washington. She's only 55, I believe.
Yeah, I think with her, if you look at the last couple months of the campaign, there was already a focus among some of her top staff about starting to think about protecting her reputation in this race, because it had gotten bad on the staff level. People were really unhappy, and she was thinking about how she could put her best foot forward. There's some irony, which we've written about too, which was she had kind of started to figure some of these things out, whether it was her prosecutor record, whether it was health care, and even start to kind of go on offense against the other candidates. And so now you have a figure in politics who, you know, she might have been polling at 4% when she dropped out, but that sort of masks her potential influence even among this field of candidates. She's probably one of the most, you know, we don't have any Teddy Kennedy's this time. There probably is not an Oprah endorsement that Obama got in 2007, 2008 that really kind of shook up that campaign and made him the legit candidate that he was. But you do have some of these former 2020 candidates. And I would say she, in the immediate future, looking ahead at the impeachment hearings where she could really sort of rebound and remind people of her star power. And so I think the combination of being a player possibly before the California primary when she has to vote herself, I think that might be the time when she weighs in. And then, of course, we saw what Biden said and others about her potential as a running mate.
As a candidate in the future.
Yes. There's that too. You know, I don't know whether for her being a senator from California, you might be in another state and you might talk about becoming something like attorney general. I don't know. It's probably a tougher call when you're a senator from sort of one of the most important states out there, whether you do that. I think, you know, down the line, if she were to take herself out of politics, there's, of course, something like the Supreme Court. You know, a lot of her heroes in law served on the Supreme Court and people she followed in politics. She was in the Alameda County courthouse as a young prosecutor. And that's, of course, where Earl Warren came from. So there's a lot of potential there.
Yeah, that's all really interesting. That's a great point you make. You know, obviously, she wasn't polling well in those head-to-head matchups, but she is still broadly pretty popular in the Democratic Party. So we'll see what comes of that. Chris, thank you so much for taking the time to talk through it.
Of course. Thank you.
All right. So we're going to jump from talking about the Harris campaign to some of the bigger factors in the race that actually drove Harris's decision to drop out. And of course, as we mentioned earlier, we're going to be talking about the demographics of the 2020 Democratic primary and you know, how some of these early states are different than each other, what campaigns are doing to try to appeal to different kinds of voters, and specifically focusing in on the Black vote, the Hispanic vote, and what the campaigns are doing there. And we've got two Politico reporters here who have spent a lot of time and effort digging into these very questions in recent weeks. And we've got Laura Barron Lopez making her Nerdcast debut. Laura, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And another Nerdcast debut for Maya King. Maya, thank you.
Hey there. Thanks for having me.
All right. So let's jump right in. We were just talking about Harris. And Maya, you had a really interesting story last night about why Kamala Harris never broke in with the Black vote, why Cory Booker hasn't broken in yet either, for that matter. And it's been kind of from, you know, if you are listening to pundits and campaign strategists talk about the race, it's been kind of a confounding thing. There was this expectation for a very long time that Black voters might just gravitate to these Black candidates, and it never happened. What did you find?
I think one of the more interesting results of this dynamic we can find in the focus group out of South Carolina that we cited in the story, because what those voters are looking at, they're being very pragmatic in their choices for the presidency in this primary. They think that the Black candidate's campaign style needs some work, looking at their authenticity on the campaign trail, and kind of comparing that also, of course, to their favorite candidate right now, Joe Biden, who has a lot of support and who has shown time and time again that he's an ally of the Black community, that he knows how these dynamics work, and Black voters have flocked to that. And unfortunately, I mean, Kamala Harris and Cory Booker have run strong campaigns, but it pales in comparison, I think, to that giant right now.
Especially because of the Obama connection with Biden. That was something that came up again and again in these voters' conversations with the folks trying to get a handle. Mm-hmm. In this case, it was Pete Buttigieg's campaign trying to find out, you know, what was motivating Black voters in South Carolina. And Obama was playing a big role in that.
Absolutely. And it's name recognition. It's a track record in the White House already having been there for 8 years. And that's a lot to go up against.
Yeah. So, Laura, think more broadly about this. Obviously, Iowa, first caucus state, very heavily white. Not 100% white, very heavily white state. New Hampshire, first primary state. Not 100% white, but very, very heavily white.
Right. They're about 90.
Yeah. But then, you know, you've got – those are two of the four early states. Obviously, they play a huge role, but then there's South Carolina, where the Democratic electorate is majority Black, Nevada, where there's a huge, huge Latino population that plays a big role in the caucuses there. And so in addition to – obviously, every campaign wants to do well in Iowa, As Chris mentioned before, some of them have realized maybe a little too late that they had to do well there in order to maybe try and do well in South Carolina and Nevada. But everyone wants to do well in Iowa. Everyone wants to do in Nevada. But there's these big efforts going on by all these campaigns to appeal to a type of voter that really isn't in Iowa or New Hampshire, to try and see if they have momentum coming out of those first two states, if they can do something to sustain it and push it forward afterward when the Democratic primary electorate gets much, much more diverse.
Right, and more reflective of the party writ large and more reflective of the country writ large. And So Buttigieg, as you mentioned, is surging in Iowa and New Hampshire, and it's always great to come out on top in those in one of those two first states if he can. But again, where is your pathway after that? And it goes through black and brown voters, particularly black voters, because they are the most loyal core base of the Democratic Party. And they're big. They're not just big in South Carolina and Nevada, but also in California and also in the Super Tuesday states.
And it just so happens that these are the voters that Pete Buttigieg has had the most trouble appealing to so far. Really, there's been some rough stuff in the last couple of weeks just in terms of can actually either of you want to walk through just some of what's happened, the rollout of his big policy plan focused on black voters kind of went awry. And there's been a whole bunch of little blowups here and there.
You could almost make a comparison between the Buttigieg pitfalls and the Harris pitfalls in that they are mistakes in campaign strategy. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Buttigieg campaign has also waited a long time to get on top of these issues with black voters. I think that in the beginning, they thought that maybe it wasn't going to be as much of a problem as it has become now. And with Harris, you know, she had a lot of issues that she didn't really get on top of with the black community. Of course, her prosecutorial record was a big thing. And instead of I don't know if the word is apologizing for it, but at least instead of, you know, making black voters feel more comfortable about that, she leaned into it, saying, I can give Trump straight talk. This is actually a good thing. You know, black communities value safety. They value, you know, feeling like they have someone on their side at the top. And I think that, you know, maybe they thought that was a strong strategy, but it sort of backfired on her in the end.
And Laura Buttigieg, meanwhile, has just like never been able to break in.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a bit of a pattern for Buttigieg of not paying attention to black voters right away, not paying attention to Latino voters until it appears to be too late, potentially. That was what my reporting with one of my political colleagues, Elena Schneider, we found that in Nevada, he has done very little outreach, also in California, to Latino leaders there, just simple as trying to meet with them more or being in the state more. He also wasn't in South Carolina very much until just recently. And now he's trying to pay more attention. And a lot of voters are asking or feel as though it's just based on political necessity that he's doing this, because his campaign is starting to realize that if he has any hope of actually winning the nomination, winning Iowa isn't going to be enough, that you have to also do well with voters in the rest of these states, so black and brown voters.
And Laura, this dynamic on the reverse side of this, this has played a big role in preserving, extending, boosting the campaigns of two candidates who are still at the top of the polls, despite, I think, having the ends of the campaigns foretold by the media, by opponents, a lot of people over and over and over. I'm talking about Joe Biden, who we mentioned before has really strong support among black voters, and Bernie Sanders, who really struggled among voters of color in 2016, but has built himself a bit, you know, a good portion of his base is black voters, Latino voters, and a lot of support among certain activist groups in both those communities.
Yeah, Maya and I have both written about the fact that the two older white men are the ones that are getting the majority of minority support. So that Biden has this strong relationship with black voters, particularly older black voters. And Sanders has a strong following with young Latinos and young black voters. And Sanders decided and his campaign decided very intentionally to try to learn some of the lessons of 2016, which was we are going to focus much more closely on the Latino community, even in Iowa, because they have a growing population there. He's been one of the few candidates to actually go to Loteria nights, which are kind of – it's just a kind of bit of a bingo game in the Latino community. And then he also has paid a lot of attention to Nevada and in California to the communities there. So they very much feel as though they're seen by his campaign more this time around than last time.
And Sanders has some really key surrogates on his team, too. He's got some high-profile activists. He has people like Killer Mike, you know, Nina AOC. Turner, AOC. I mean, these are names that really carry weight in black and brown communities, and it makes a difference. And I think getting back to Buttigieg, who has struggled with these communities, it's a lesson he'll have to learn. You cannot just walk into a church or a barbershop in South Carolina and ask for the vote. You might earn respect and you might earn name recognition, but I'm not sure if you'll earn the actual support that you need. And this is something that Sanders learned in 2016 and something that I think the Buttigieg campaign is finally catching on to. One thing that I'm actually waiting for from them is the bus tour to drive through states like South Carolina or Georgia or Tennessee, states with strong black populations that would probably be very receptive to something like that.
Yeah. And Laura, I mean, you're doing a little bit of reporting right now on basically it seems like the Buttigieg campaign, having had such a rough time in the summer with they rolled out this policy plan and then got criticized for basically putting it, names of people on it who said that they weren't actually supporting the plan or weren't supporting the candidate. There have been a number of documented issues of kind of racial issues in South Bend as he's been mayor. And so it seems like the Buttigieg campaign has decided almost before they even start asking for people's votes, they need to do a little repair work. They need to do a little bit of introduction work. And that's both with voters in South Carolina and also with, you know, with black elites in the halls of Congress.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a big piece of all of these campaigns is having surrogates that are willing to go out there and talk you up and talk about you and make the connections with the communities that you need to make connections with. And Buttigieg doesn't have really that many connections with any of the members of Congress. And so what I've been reporting on is that Buttigieg is starting to try to make connections with members of Congress, particularly members of the Congressional Black Caucus, members of the Congressional Hispanic Caucus, in especially younger, newer members who maybe don't have ties to Obama or Biden and who may be more open to what he is – to his candidacy, ones that lean a bit more moderate. And so his campaign has been pitching some of them, saying that they take the issue seriously that they've had in the past of not connecting with black voters. And they're trying to clearly get some endorsements there.
But at the same time, maybe not pushing for them directly right now. It's like starting kind of a long process of conversation toward doing that.
No, that's right. So what we found is that he has a few congressional endorsements. They're all from white lawmakers. Congressman Don Beyer has been talking to other members, congressional black lawmakers, telling them, look, I don't want to push you right now to endorse Buttigieg, but please look at the Douglas plan. I think that he is definitely serious about trying to use his administration, if he is elected, to focus on the black community and right past wrongs.
Got it. And Laura, it seems like this question of demographic support in the Democratic primary, the demographic makeup of the Democratic primary is getting a lot more attention now. Not only with Kamala Harris dropping out, but with other candidates of color so far, at least as of today, not qualifying for the December debate stage.
That's right. Cory Booker of New Jersey and former Housing and Urban Development Secretary Julian Castro are not going to qualify for December. And they've started to talk a lot about the fact that the party, whether it's the debate qualifications or also the fact that Iowa and New Hampshire go first, is not living up to what it trumpets, which is pretty much that we are the most diverse party. We are now paying more attention to black women, which are the most loyal voting base. And so they're very frustrated by the fact that the December debate stage could very well be a debate stage where it's just all white candidates.
And Maya, Castro has been spending a lot of time talking about this Iowa and New Hampshire issue in the last few months of his campaign. He hasn't made the debate stage in a little while. I think he's been using these months. He's not really moving in the polls either, but he's been using these months to put forward some issues that he feels are really important To voters of color in the Democratic primary.
And I think that's one of the biggest reasons why his supporters are so disappointed to see him not make the debate stage, is the fact that he speaks to these issues that they don't often hear their other white candidates talk about. He has pushed the party very left on issues like immigration, reparations. It's a story that Laura and I have written about. These are topics that black and brown voters really care about and want to see pushed forward on the debate stage and on the campaign trail. And candidates like Julian Castro and Cory Booker were really getting into those topics. But without them on the stage, you know, it's really a huge question mark of whether or not white candidates will pick up that mantle.
We'll just have to see what happens. Laura, thank you so much for coming to talk about it.
Thank you.
And Maya, thank you as well.
Thanks for having me.
Quick note before we get in the credits. As we mentioned during the show, Politico is co-hosting the next Democratic primary debate with PBS NewsHour. That's going to be on December 19th in Los Angeles. And in the week leading up to that, keep an eye out for a lot of special Nerdcast episodes. We're going to have stuff from the ground, from the large Politico contingent that's going to be out there in LA leading up to the debate. We will, of course, have our usual debate wrap-up episode after the debate happens. And just a lot of content coming your way. We're really excited. Hope you'll have a listen to that in the week leading up to that event. All right. Our producer on this episode was Annie Reese with an assist from Jenny Ament. Our illustrator is Bill Cookman. If you like the Nerdcast and you're listening on Apple Podcasts, please do us a favor and leave a review. It helps new listeners find the show. Once again, thank you so much for listening. We'll talk to you again next week.